Hello, Western Wisconsin. This is Spectrum West. And you know, it's the fall pledge drive. We're counting on Spectrum Westerners to respond in a big way. We're fortunate to get a bunch of emails each week with thanks for certain segments and guests and suggestions for the same. And this is your opportunity to show the kind of support that ensures the longevity of the vehicle on which we are heard. Wisconsin Public Radio, where over 40% of our budget depends on people just like you. We thank you. Proud of bring you this week's rendition of our weekly arts, music, culture, Wisconsin, and humanities spotlight. And I'm Al Russ. This week's show includes Wallace Rogers, who's coordinating the general fund raising effort. That's fundraising effort. Should have put a dash there. In support of the Confluence Project projected to downtown Eau Claire. The Marvelous Master Singers begin their 22nd season on Sunday, and director Gary Schwartzoff delivers a preview from his UWEC office. Jim Oliver talks with popular author and educator John Hildebrand about his latest of four books, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern almanac. And the near north side of Eau Claire is where some historic things have transpired. You have the chance to learn about a few during a Saturday morning bus tour and lunch. We have details from Historic Preservation Foundation members Janice Nukowski and Corrine Charlson. And all those introductions begin in just a couple of minutes. This is Spectrum West. Sunday afternoon, the 22nd season of The Master Singers begins. And music director Dr. Gary Schwartzoff of the UW-Eau Claire Choral Department took time from his busy schedule to provide a preview of what we can anticipate in this and in upcoming appearances. You have a new composer in residence this year. Tell me about Zachary Moore.
Zachary Moore is a senior Bachelor of Music Education choral major here at UW-Eau Claire. He has been writing for several years now, works for the concert choir here on campus. He's also done numerous commissioned pieces for some area schools. His works that he has composed, he has submitted for national competitions. One recently finished third place. I mean, this is for young university students competing with professional composers.
What's the history of composers in residence? I kind of got close to the Master Singers the last couple of years, and Andrew Steffen was involved then. Been a long line of them, or is this kind of a new phenomenon?
It is a new project to generate new works for the choral arts, primarily, obviously for the Master Singers themselves. You know, having a composer in residence, if it's an established composer, can get very expensive. Each of these two gentlemen, I feel, is quite exceptional. Andy Steffen, who was with us for two seasons, has now gone on to study at University of Oklahoma with Z. Randall Stroop. And now Zachary Moore is in his first year, might possibly do one more. Next year he'll be a student for part of the year and then student teach.
Let's talk about the piece to which he is applying music and arrangement.
The poem is just a lovely setting of fall in Wisconsin. There are references to Eau Claire in here, in particular our two rivers. When you embark on a project like this, you never quite know how it's going to end up, but this is really a lovely, lovely score that I think will be enjoyed by many, not just our audience, but many other audiences to come. It's entitled October Song, again with words by Max Garland and set by Zachary Moore. The piece is for SATB Choir, cello solo, which Caitlin Witherspoon, a cellist here on campus, is going to play, and piano. It's a lovely setting. The imagery, I think, that Max has generated in this poem really inspired Zachary Moore in the setting of this piece.
So what else is on the program for Sunday?
Four pastorals by Cecil Effinger, poems by Thomas Hornsby Farrell, who also was a poet in residence in Colorado. That piece features a oboist, Jonathan Konjerski, a university student as well, who writes beautifully. A setting of Go Lovely Rose by Z. Randall Stroop, whom we've commissioned to write for this ensemble numerous times. Red River Valley, which is not around Eau Claire here, but a beautiful American folk song nonetheless. There's a theme of sort of water and nature in this concert, so we're doing Eric Whitaker's Water Night. The folk song, The Water is Wide, O Wally Wally, setting by John Craig Hella Johnson. Aaron Copland's parlor song entitled Long Time Ago, a parlor song or ballad, if you would, we think fits nicely into the program. And a piece Bid Me Home, Wisconsin. That's not had a lot of performances here in the state. Copyright on the piece is 1992. Julie Gardner-Bray wrote the piece and speaks about life here in Wisconsin, so that will conclude our concert.
What other pleasant surprises do you have planned for us in your now 22nd season?
Well, we're pleased to have Ken Pereira, a voice faculty member here at UW-Eau Claire, joining us as the narrator in this concert. Zach Moore is finishing up his commission piece for Christmas, so Zach is writing a piece for each of the three concerts. And then for Easter, we're doing a Requiem setting by Bob Chilcott, an English composer. It will be the main piece of that concert.
Dr. Gary Schwartzoff there. The Master Singers, I understand we may have earlier this week been mistakenly identifying the concert as on Saturday. It is on Sunday. We apologize for that. The Master Singers, 2 p.m. Sunday at First Lutheran Church in Eau Claire. Tickets at Morgan Music, Schmidt Music, First Congregational United Church of Christ, all in Eau Claire, and tickets at the door, too. Take in the Master Singers. You'll wonder why you didn't do that a bit sooner. They're raising money to build the downtown dream. That's next on Spectrum West.
Support for WPR comes from Ashland County Tourism, offering Follow the Mural Brick Road, a tour of historic murals, including a treasure hunt held during the fall season of color through November in Ashland County. Details at muralbrickroad.com. Support also comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony. Music from Respighi and Tchaikovsky is featured in the 40th Anniversary Extravaganza, October 11th at the State Theater. Details at 832-6366 or at cvsymphony.org.
Here's a Spectrum memo. This weekend, Saturday and Sunday, the Western Wisconsin Pottery Tour in and around River Falls featuring three locations, 13 potters. Maps and details at westernwisconsinpotterytour.com. This is Spectrum West. Good to have you along today. Wallace Rogers has taken on the responsibility of coordinating a campaign to raise funds for the Confluence Project, the complex currently assigned to downtown Eau Claire. Rogers was a member of the Eau Claire City Council from 85 to 93, a time of mostly business as usual. Today, Eau Claire has something big to chew on, munching for the better part of a few years already. It's passed inspection on several levels. Now it's time for individuals and groups of individuals, commercial and otherwise, to show their encouragement. We had a chat with Wallace Rogers. What do you think is different today? In my 24 years in this neighborhood, people have talked about the fact that Eau Claire doesn't have what they're hopefully going to get now, and that La Crosse does and other towns do, but there just wasn't the impetus or the spark. What's different today, do you think?
Well, I think it's an idea. The Confluence Project, a mixed-use building, downtown redevelopment, the Performing Arts Center, a nice plaza, extensions of the bike paths and the hiking paths and things, and then all that's gone on the other side of the river, I think, has been a really big factor with Jamf and then all the residential development, Phoenix Park, those kinds of things. I think when people saw that happening, they really thought that there was a real chance we could do something significant downtown.
An infrastructure was built to support wider dreams.
Yeah. I mean, it's a really innovative use of tax increment financing, which helps hard to develop places like downtown. And, you know, the downtown really needed a shot in the arm. Nothing sustainable or nothing comprehensive like this in the past 30 years.
And most of that has been private investment.
Yeah. The fact of the matter is you can't do development on a big scale anymore without some local government help or local government involvement. It's just too difficult to do. And you can see that every place, whether you look at a big city like Minneapolis or smaller towns our size.
Your job as coordinator is to, guess what? Coordinate.
Yeah.
The raising of over $13 million is a major ingredient in this cake that we're baking. Tell us about the structure that's going to help all this become a reality. What have you had to build here?
We've actually got six different initiatives, different types of ways we're raising funds. And five of those are locally, big givers, corporations. My job, besides being a coordinator for all these programs, making sure we're all moving in the same direction at the same speed, is to write the grant applications for foundation funding, which of that $13.5 million targets $2.2 million. And we're beginning to get those applications out.
That's the voice of Wally Rogers. He's the campaign coordinator for the Confluence Project fundraising effort. And man, is it an effort. Fundraising, the word fun is in fundraising. It can be fun. You have some areas of competition that you've instituted in it. Did you have a brainstorming session?
There was a lot of discussion about ways we could raise money before I came on as the coordinator. Yeah. There is a corporate giving and a corporate match component there, mm-hmm. and the number of businesses that are signing on for the match programs increasing. We have a steering committee that people are heading all the different components of the fundraising effort, and they're doing real well on that on the corporate side.
I keep remembering all the telethons I've watched over the years from the time I was a kid, and it really is true what they say there, and that is that from an individual level, every little bit helps.
Oh, yeah.
The young people especially, because this is going to be their baby in the years to come.
Yeah, there's even one of our components is a text to give. You know, you can send in a dollar. And then we've got a 70 for 50 program where we're identifying 70 people in the community who give at least $50,000. So that's a pretty substantial donation. So everything in between is what we're looking to do.
There's also naming opportunities. What's out there?
There's naming opportunities for the three theaters in the Performing Arts Center, for the Performing Arts Center itself, even things outside like a bikeway pedestrian bridge between Phoenix Park and the site, you know, as a candidate for a naming project. Fountain in the plaza between the mixed-use building and the Performing Arts Center is a candidate for naming.
Well, that's exciting stuff. But you look at paper and you see 2018 and you say, man, that seems like a long way off. Mm. In reality, it isn't. There's a lot of work to do within those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like our fundraising effort, we're running it till August to raise this $13.5 million. And the reason why the push is till August next year is because the non-state agency grant that was big news a couple of weeks ago that went into Madison for $25 million. It's a line item in the biennium state's budget. So the budget approval process kind of runs through August. So we want to have that fundraising in place at the time. Hopefully we'll have the $25 million because it's contingent on us raising some of this money locally.
Yeah, and I've learned every time you do want a large sum of money from anyone, they do want to know that your community is behind what you're doing.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
And that's what this is all about.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's finish our conversation with telling people about how they can get involved. You've talked about six levels. People still have questions. Where do they go?
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got a really good arrangement with the Eau Claire Community Foundation.
Okay.
They have a website. In fact, we're running all of our undesignated donations for the project through the Eau Claire Community Foundation. They've got lots of experience doing this kind of work. So if you look on the Eau Claire Community Foundation's website, you can see the reference to the Confluence Center. They're fronting all of our foundation grant applications. It's just a great, great working relationship. So they can give through the foundation. Or if they have associations with ECRAC, the Eau Claire Regional Arts Council, State Theater, they can give through that kind of a mechanism also.
All right. Thanks. Wallace Rogers, Rogers & Associates. He's taken on the job of campaign coordinator for the Confluence Project fundraising effort. Thank you for consenting to do that. Thanks for your civic service in that regard, and good luck with it all.
Well, thanks for asking me to be on your show.
The dream is alive and the wheels keep turning, similar to what's on our minds at Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Author John Hildebrand talks with Jim Oliver. That's coming up. Hey, it's National 4-H Week. Did you know that? Congratulations to all the young people keeping 4-H strong and helping themselves get that way, too, in so many ways. That's pretty cool. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross. Good to have you with us. On this Thursday or Friday evening, if you're listening then. Nothing like curling up with a good book on a crisp autumn day, and although I can't vouch for the curling part, I know Jim Oliver likes to settle in and do the same. It appears he's done that recently, and he'd like to tell you about it.
The Chippewa Valley Book Festival opens Monday and continues through October 23rd at various venues around the Chippewa Valley. Among the nearly 30 authors who will be making presentations during the festival is John Hildebrand, professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. Professor Hildebrand is here to talk about his latest book and the book he will be talking about at the festival, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Nice to be here.
Well, according to the book festival's website, you'll be talking about your book and then about creating literary journalism. So would you define literary journalism for
me? Well, that's easy, even though this particular book isn't really literary journalism. Literary journalism just means when you use narrative devices to tell a true story. And that can be just characterization. It can be, you know, building up a symbol. It's the use of dialogue, not just, you know, where you ask somebody for a quote, but you listen to somebody talk and, you know, you try to write about their life, not just them as a spokesperson. So I've done that. Yeah, this is my fourth book. I've also written a book of travel, but this is the first time I really have written about my home, written about the Midwest.
Mm-hmm. Now, you have a journalism degree from the University of Michigan.
Yeah.
So what led you off into this other tangent of being an English professor?
Yeah, that's strange. I had a BA in journalism from Michigan. I went out to San Francisco to get a job. I couldn't find a job. I ended up as an ice cream scooper. I quit that. I moved to Alaska. I started building a cabin. I couldn't get the cabin done. So I did what a lot of people do when they face failure, is I went to grad school. I had a choice between more journalism or creative writing, and I went into creative writing, but I found really that I could combine the two so that I could write about real people, real things, but I could tell a story as well. I could use all the devices that a short story writer might use in order to talk about, you know, actual things.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac.
Well, it's 52 short essays. I did a regular column for Wisconsin Trails for about 7 years, in which I would write six of these pieces a year. They had to be short, they had to be seasonal, and they had to be regional. And what I tried to do is write about maybe the things that were kind of hiding in plain sight. There's something Hemingway once said. He said, the hard part in writing is figuring out what you truly feel as opposed to what you're supposed to feel. And I think tourism is all about how you're supposed to feel. But, you know, our feelings about, you know, the life around us, our everyday sort of things, they're complex and they're kind of deep-seated, and I try to get into that. The first piece I wrote was about church suppers, which is, you know, a common enough experience in the Midwest, especially in winter.
Mm-hmm.
I did that because I would volunteer as a dishwasher at the Immaculate Conception fish boil. I'd come home after, you know, 3 hours of washing dishes, my hands, you know, wrinkled and red, and I smelled like tartar sauce. But I found, you know, this is fun. Why do I enjoy this? Why is it fun?
Mm-hmm.
Why do people, you know, plunk $8 down to sit in a school cafeteria and eat boiled fish? And I think a lot of it is it's a social context. You know, you leave your home on a cold night and you get to sit with people, some that you know and some strangers, and you get to see folks that you may only know in their professional guys, you know, the dentist, the salesman, the priest, and you get to see another side of them. And in some ways, that sort of set the tone for the book, which is to look at what's kind of common around us and see another side of it, something maybe unexpected.
I noticed that most of the essays, which I enjoyed all of them thoroughly, I'll just come right out and say that. I'm not trying to polish you up here too much, but anyway, it was fun. It was fun to read. But I noticed a lot of the stuff, which makes perfect sense, I guess, in the Upper Midwest, is a lot of it was about your experiences out of doors.
Well, that's one of the reasons I live here. I love the outdoors. I try to write not just about, you know, the woods and the streams and lakes, but also about agriculture, about farming. And so I would kind of go back and forth between those two things. What I like about being outdoors is the unexpected. One of the reasons people like to hunt, the reason I like to hunt is not necessarily that I'm going to get a deer, but I always know I'm going to see something unexpected, and that's what I'll come away with. I'll come away with a story about something. I saw, a weasel or a flock of turkeys or whatever. Mm. And that's what I wrote about. But, these things are connected. There's one piece that begins, we're sitting around a farm field waiting for the moon to come up. And this is down at my wife's family farm. And the whole field, the cornfields, as far as you can see, are just sort of throbbing with fireflies. And the fireflies, the hatch had been very heavy because apparently there had been a drought and that followed by a wet spring, and somehow this was conducive to fireflies. And there was a kind of these two emotions. One is I'm sitting surrounded by family members, people I really care about, but I'm also in this place, and I'm seeing this kind of wonderful light show. So it's, I think that's not uncommon in the Midwest.
He is John Hildebrand, author of The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Well, one of my favorite essays among many is strange because I grew up on a farm like your wife did.
Yeah.
And I hated chickens with a passion. But yet the one about the great urban chicken controversy I found amusing and a lot of fun.
I had a lot of fun writing about it. And I don't really have a horse or a chicken in this particular race. And I've got friends on both sides. What I found kind of amusing is the way that, the dispute over raising urban chickens mirrored kind of our larger political disputes. There were the one side, which I'll call the agents of change, and they were arguing that not only would, raising chickens lead to, cheap protein and so forth, but it was so much more, it was a healthy lifestyle and this and that. And then they were countered by what I call the forces of reaction, who had a compelling narrative of their own, and that narrative could be reduced to a single word: no, never. And as you point out, a lot of those people grew up on farms. Mm-hmm. Very definite idea what life in the city is supposed to be like, and chickens aren't part of it. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we define things too narrowly. This is the way it is in the city. This is the way it is in the country. Never the twain shall meet. I wouldn't mind if the neighbors had some chickens.
Yeah. I had some neighbors with chickens, actually, in a little village and outside of the bigger town where I worked. There were some people who had some chickens. But the only reason I knew that is because the rooster would crow every morning.
Yeah.
Other than that, they were just, they just weren't there. And I have no idea how many they had or what they used them for or anything.
Yeah.
So, I found that a fairly pointless argument, but I guess some people took it very seriously. As I drive about the countryside, and I have been the last couple of weeks for a variety of reasons, and you look at the crumbling farm sites and you worry about, a way of life disappearing, that your wife and I and others like us who grew up on farms and feel like we're one generation away from the farm, and yet so many kids aren't. But you had an essay about farm beginnings, that the number of farms actually increased.
The number of farms did increase. The first time, I think, since the census began asking about agriculture. And the increase wasn't in farms that raised corn or soybeans or beef cattle. They tend to be small farms and niche products. But it's a way, I think, to repopulate the countryside. The reason I wrote about it is my wife had enrolled in that program. She and her sister got together to raise raspberries commercially. Hmm. And what got me the feeling of optimism, that maybe we had turn the corner on the declining farm population, but also, and again, broadening the definition of how we see farms. And I think that's important.
Do you have a writing routine for your essays? Do you get up every morning at 6 o'clock and start writing, or do you write when the spirit moves you?
I wish I had a routine. The nice thing about writing is that you don't have to be a winner the first time out. So when I'm writing about something, I'll scratch out some ideas. I'll type a rough draft. I'll throw that away. I'll do another draft. It's not like I know what I'm going to say. when I start writing. Writing is a way to figure out what it is I want to say. So I'll get into that process. And sometimes I'm deep into it because I'm working on something. And other times, you know, there's kind of a lull period where I'm not sure what I'm going to write about.
You know, it's interesting. Years ago, and I wish I could remember who said this, but somebody said that the presidents and other politicians ought to write their own speeches because writing is the best way to organize your thoughts and develop your own ideas. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I agree very much. One of the writers I used to teach when I taught composition was Abraham Lincoln, because his speeches are very beautifully constructed arguments. But more than that, I mean, they're terrific essays, and I think it's a useful skill to know how to persuade somebody. You know, not to yell at them, not to hit them over the head with slogans, but to know how to persuade. What an essay is, it's almost always a kind of act of persuasion. It's always saying, you know, I want you to see it my way, but I know you might not be there right at the beginning. So I'm going to start where I think you are, and then over a number of paragraphs, I'm going to try to get you over to my position. In some ways, that's kind of what I've tried to do in these essays.
So where is the book available?
It is at the local store. Mm-hmm. It's also at the university bookstore, and it's available at Amazon.
Well, the book is The Heart of Things, A Midwestern Almanac. We've been talking to the author, John Hildebrand, who is professor of English at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. He'll be one of the presenters during the Chippewa Valley Book Festival. You'll be talking about the book at the local store at Volume 1 headquarters at 7 p.m. on Tuesday. John Hildebrand, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Support for WPR comes from Wild Birds Unlimited in Madison, announcing a bird food event through October, including seed, suet, and seed cylinders. Info at wbumadison.com. Discover a refuge in your own backyard. Support also comes from the 15th Annual Chippewa Valley Book Festival, featuring more than 25 authors, including David Rhodes, Nicholas Butler, and Christina Baker Klein, October 13th through the 23rd. More information at cvbookfest.org.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. The near north side of Eau Claire has some interesting history. We'll touch on a bit of it and tell you how to ride along next on Spectrum West. Speaking of nexts, next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, enjoy the 7th Earth Arts Fall Salon Art Exhibit, Reflections, at the Cafe Wren Community Room in Luck, Wisconsin. Their website is earthartswi.org. Next Saturday, the 18th, Theater in the Woods celebrates 25 years with 25 plays in 25 minutes. 7 p.m. at the Erica Kwam Memorial Theater, that is in Shell Lake. Well, Saturday, the Eau Claire Historic Preservation Foundation is hosting a bus tour, a short but informative excursion to the near north side in which some interesting things have transpired over the years. Janice Nukowski is president. Corrine Charlson is one of the resident historians who started our conversation with a bit of foundation history.
Back in the 60s, it all started through the wonderful efforts of Connie Lotz. She was very disturbed hearing that the city was ready to tear down our wonderful railroad station.
Ah.
So she had big ideas as to what we could do with it. And that's really how Historic Preservation Foundation started.
How successful was the plan to save the train station? Because I don't see one.
No, it failed. They collected a lot of money for the preservation of it, but it ended up being torn down and made into a parking lot.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing, though, that since the 1960s, there have been a lot of victories and there have been a lot of things preserved, yes? Otherwise, the Historic Preservation Foundation wouldn't be around this many years.
Really? We're still trying to save things. Unfortunately, we're not very successful. recent example is the Confluence Project.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We attempted to save the buildings on South Barstow Street, and we're unsuccessful. We keep fighting.
Well, tell me some of the things you have saved, because you haven't lost them all, have you?
Yes, we have.
Ah.
Yes, we've lost them all so far. Probably our next endeavor will be trying to save the Barnes Building and the State Theater, because if the new Confluence Project with the Art Center goes through, there won't be any need for the State Theater. So we're hoping that we can get a head start on getting information out to people and hoping we can get more support to save those buildings if the need should arise. Our other interest is in educating on the history of Eau Claire.
Mm-hmm.
We like to educate the public with the tours and have been very successful.
All right. In the studio with us, Janice Nukowski and Corrine Charlson, and they are members of the Eau Claire Historic Preservation Foundation. The reason they're here is they have a Near North Side bus tour Saturday from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Tell me about the uniqueness of the North Side.
There's a Sears catalog home that we're going to be viewing. They began offering their kits in the United States in 1908. They offered a variety of styles, an opportunity for people to own their first modern home.
Sure.
You could either purchase a kit, which came in two or three carloads. It was mm-hmm. the full plans and everything for the house. Or you could just purchase the blueprints.
I think a lot of, if not most, communities in the Midwest, the one I grew up in, I remember there were some Sears homes. And I'm wondering if Montgomery Ward had homes, too, just to compete. Because those were the two biggies back then. You know, when you hear about this bus tour and you see the release that you put out about it, the first thing that catches your eye is the Ku Klux Klan. I lived in the South for a while. It's not surprising there. It's kind of surprising here.
Their interest was not just African-American. They were opposed to religious organizations as well.
Sure.
It was mainly a men's social and political club. They would burn crosses occasionally.
This was just to the North Side? They had a nest of Klan members there? Is that what you're saying?
Well, this particular tour is going to talk about one of the activities they did, and it was in the North Side.
Ah. So now people familiar with Eau Claire, tell me, what do we mean by the North Side, the Near North Side? Corrine?
North of the Eau Claire River.
Okay.
Actually, we used to consider, when my grandparents were living on the Near North Side, it was below the hill.
Uh-huh.
But this tour is going to include up on the hill.
Okay. Okay.
Mount Simon and a little bit east.
People now are interested. They're interested in the bus tour. They're also interested in helping the foundation do what they do.
They can contact me, Janice Nukowski, at 715-832-2108, or they can email Kirsten Slott at slaghtk@uwec.edu. Our trip is going to be $35, and it includes lunch. It's a Bruce Gardo tour, and he's been nice enough to allow us to use it as a fundraiser.
Corrine Charlson and Janice Nukowski, thanks for being with us. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So the quickest way to reserve your seat on Saturday's tour is the phone number that Janice gave us, and here it is, 715-832-2108. And, you know, watch for more historic home and neighborhood tours possibly coming down the road from the Eau Claire Historic Preservation Foundation.
Here's what's on stage in Western Wisconsin theater venues. Sideways Stories from Wayside School, a production of the Eau Claire Children's Theater, will play Friday and Saturday at the Oxford Theater in Eau Claire. The Festival Theater of St. Croix Falls will present The Miser through Sunday. The play will run weekends through October 26th. The Spell of Sleeping Beauty will be performed by the Phipps Children's Theater Friday through Sunday at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Mystery Cafe production of Murder, She Tweeted will play Friday and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson. The show will play Fridays and Saturdays through November 1st. The Menominee Theater Guild will hold auditions for It's a Wonderful Life from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday and Tuesday at the Theater Guild Studio in Menominee. And that's some of what's happening in live theater around the region. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
You sure are. Thanks for supporting WPR and for being a friend of Spectrum West. Couldn't do it without you. The Chippewa Valley Symphony is holding a poster contest for young people K through 12. They're looking for designs for the last four concerts of this year. Not this year, but 2014 and 2015. Cash prizes will be awarded. November 21st is the deadline. You can get the details at the website, cvsymphony.org, or call director Tony Zammit at 832-6366. Don't forget, the symphony presents its first concert of the season, the 40th anniversary extravaganza, Saturday evening, 7:30 p.m., State Theater. Also, big reminder, the 15th Chippewa Valley Book Festival starting Monday, running through Thursday, the 23rd. Authors in schools, adult writing workshops, author readings and appearances, dinner with authors. Way too much to mention here. Go to the website, cvbookfest.org, and read all about it. Hey, in coming weeks on Spectrum West, the Planetarium opens on special Mondays at UW River Falls. The return of the Woodturners and their exceptional craft. Harp player, as in harmonica, Corky Siegel will be here. Eau Claire Jazz is planning another annual event to anticipate. And then remember, there's more. Always more on Spectrum West. Thanks to Lauren Segrin for promotional leadership, Dean Collenbach and John Gatto for telling our story, Tiffany Coggins for keeping the ball rolling, etc., etc., etc. So many people it takes. I'm Al Ross. Thanks. See you next week.